This episode of the UAV Digest is sponsored by GoEngineer, provider of design, engineering, and 3D printing solutions for the aerospace and unmanned vehicles industries. To learn more, visit the UAVDigest.com/GoEngineer. You're listening to episode 46 of the UAV Digest. I'm Max Flight in Hartford, Connecticut.
And I'm David Vanderhoof in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Hey, Max, how are you?
Very well, David. We have something very interesting for all of our listeners this episode. We were down at the Smithsonian's National Air and Space Museum for the Become a Pilot Day, the 2014 iteration of that event. And we were able to speak with a couple of very interesting people when we were down there, and we recorded our conversation. So who do we have for this episode, David?
This episode, we're going to talk with Roger Connor. Roger is the curator of UAVs for the Smithsonian Institution. And I think we actually had a really interesting conversation. I know I came away, being a historian, with some knowledge that I didn't ever expect, like where the word drone comes from.
That's right. It was a fascinating conversation. You'll be hearing that in just a second. And Roger talked about things like the origins of the term, the history of UAVs, some of the exhibits they have at the Smithsonian there, and also things like some of the future, where we're going with some of the regulatory issues, the impacts of that. And interestingly enough, we'll hear from Roger about why the Smithsonian turned down the X-47. So that was very interesting.
For most people who don't realize, the Smithsonian, they usually get the right to refuse the subject matter. And this that X-47 discussion is really interesting about why Roger said no to picking that up for the museum, because he wants something better coming along. So I guess with that, we should roll that beautiful UAV footage, huh, Max?
That's right, and we'll come back on the other side. So here's Roger Connor.
You're listening to UAV Digest, and Max and I are actually not broadcasting looking at each other via Skype tonight, but we're actually at the Udvar-Hazy Center for Pilot Day 14. And we have with us the curator of UAVs for the Smithsonian, Roger Connors. Rogers, thank you for being on the UAV Digest.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
We're talking about a subject that I guess most people wouldn't realize that UAVs, we would have museum exhibits at the Smithsonian of UAVs. They normally think of Predators, Reapers, and DJI Phantoms in our universe currently. But tell us a little bit about what the museum has for UAVs.
Well, we actually do have some of that. We currently do have a Predator on display downtown on the mall. In fact, it's probably the most historic Predator in existence. It was the first Predator to undergo operational trials with a Hellfire, and actually the first Predator to fire a Hellfire in combat as well.
Tell me a little bit about the history of UAVs, and maybe you can go back to the Predator or before the Predator. Most people don't realize there's drones and UAVs have a long history. Mm-hmm. And what other exhibits would someone see if they were interested? In the Smithsonian, we're looking at things like Sarans and B-29s and stuff, but tell us a little bit more about what's curated here for UAVs.
Absolutely. Well, you may know that the unmanned aircraft goes back a long way. I mean, we can go back to 1914 when Elmer Sperry was demonstrating his autopilot. And by that point, people like H.G. Wells had already envisioned airplanes being operated autonomously as weapons. And certainly during World War I, there was a huge push to implement that type of strategy. We see the aerial torpedo, the Kettering bug, for instance. These were forerunners of the V-1, so essentially a winged airplane with an autopilot and a warhead that was sent on its way. By the early 1920s, there's a lot of interest in active radio control. Again, mainly as an aerial torpedo. The Navy was interested in having something they could steer into ships. By the late 1920s, early 1930s, what's evolved is the modern target drone, so equipping a full-size aircraft that allows gunners, particularly on naval vessels, to get real-world training in shooting at aircraft, because it's a very hard thing to train somebody to that's never done it before under real-life conditions.
Yeah, it's kind of funny. We talked about that the other day with the picture of Marilyn Monroe working on her little target in World War II as a Rosie the Riveter, say.
Yeah, she was at the Denny radio plane plant. The big push, of course, was both the drone itself came about, the terminology came out by Delmar Farney, who was the naval officer that brought the British technology for these naval gunnery drones over to the U.S. in 1935. They were calling those aircraft the Queen Bee in the Royal Air Force. And he wanted to recognize that fact but come up with something different. And he was the one that came up with drone as the terminology for unmanned aircraft.
That's awesome. That's something that most of our listeners probably wouldn't know. That's a really neat piece of trivia that we will be carrying on forever.
And so during World War II, you get weaponized versions. There's a forerunner of the Predator. You see the TDR-1, for instance, which is it's an aircraft that's remotely controlled with a television camera. It carries external ordnance. It's used operationally in the Pacific. So really all the kind of basic ideas of the Predator are already there and even in operational use to some extent during World War II. Of course, after the end of World War II, you get kind of this differentiation between the pilotless missile and then the unmanned aircraft, remotely piloted aircraft. And what we see today in terms of Predator, I think, is something that's not something that's more than the sum of its technology. With Predator, it's not simply having a good TV camera with a good weapon system. What's really made Predator, I think, and ushered in this revolution that we're having right now is the fact that we're able to control these things in real time on the other side of the world. That was something that was just really not expected. And when that capability came in, really at the end of the 1990s, I mean, only in the last 15 years have we had that capability. And that's really changed warfare in some very unexpected ways. So that's an issue that that we like to talk about here at the museum to some extent. But we have a lot of unmanned systems that go back a lot further back. So we've got some of those naval gunnery targets from the World War II era. We have at the end of this building here on the north side, we have a drone helicopter from the Vietnam era called the Dash, the QH-50 Dash. We currently display that Dash with some ordnance on it. The ordnance in question is a Mark 57 nuclear depth bomb with a yield of about 14 kilotons, so essentially what the Nola Gay behind us delivered on Hiroshima. The whole idea behind...
Well, that's a very telling thing, that how nuclear weapons shrunk in size.
Yes.
Yeah, so a lot of people don't realize that we were actually deploying remote-controlled helicopters with nuclear bombs attached to them back in the early 1960s. The idea there was that with the Soviet nuclear subs coming into the fold, it was going to be a lot harder to counter the Soviet naval presence. So in desperation, they took a whole bunch of World War II-era destroyers out of mothballs, cut the back decks off of them so they could put a helicopter on there, but they didn't have enough room for a full-size helicopter, so they went with a drone helicopter. They weren't going to have any sort of accuracy in locating these subs, so they needed something that had a big kill radius. So they initially deployed with a nuclear depth bomb. Was the model they went with.
Sounds a little bit like a Genie missile, which has always been described as taking flies out with sledgehammers.
Exactly, and this was a real hazardous weapon to deploy for the ship in question. They were not going to operate these drones much past their line of sight, so... they might have these things flying out, 10, 15 miles, but if that thing went off and you were within the 10-mile radius, it was bad news for your ship, too.
So we've talked a little about military drones. What about civilian and the new revolution that we have with civilian drones? what does the museum foresee, or is there anything that they're looking to curate about?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, obviously just the last couple years in particular have been really remarkable in terms of what we've seen. So one of our latest additions, we have the Dragon Flyer X4 coming in.
Oh.
And the one in particular that we've acquired is it's supposedly the first drone to save a life in police service. And it was the Canadian Mounties that were using it in Canada a couple years back, where they had somebody that was in a car accident. Temperature was below 20 degrees below zero. Guy wanders off with a head injury, and they actually flew the Dragon Flyer out with a FLIR. There's a FLIR small enough to mount on one of these things, and they found the guy, saved his life. And so kind of a historic example there. You're probably familiar with the FAA operation that's up on the North Shore of Alaska.
Yes.
That was approved last year. And we've been working with In Situ, you know, associated with Boeing, on acquiring one of the Scan Eagles that was in that first operation there. So these are our first kind of real civilian UAVs to come in the modern sense.
Yeah, we should mention that all of the exhibits here have some historical significance, or there's some aspect to them that makes them unique. They're not just a random collection of aircraft.
Yeah, absolutely. When we acquire something, we typically want to get the best example, or something that has a really remarkable, rich history to it. It's not simply having something that has a nice paint scheme on it. We want something that really resonates as the real thing.
So we've talked about the history. What do you think is the future?
Well, this is a remarkable time, obviously. I've been almost dumbfounded just in the last couple months at how things are moving, both in terms of this kind of regulatory fight that we've seen.
Which we talk about on a weekly basis.
Yes.
It amazes me that we're kind of in the situation that we're in, to be honest. You know, it's clear that we're not going to have Amazon delivery drones in the next 5-10 years. You know, some of this stuff is obviously a pretty far reach. But in terms of, a camera platform, the civil UAV is out of the box. The genie is out of the box. There's no doubt about it. And it's a different world now.
It is, for sure. Hey, tell us a little bit about your background. How did you come to be in this position?
Well, I started as a CFI. So, I started flying at a young age out of college. I wound up flight instructing. I had UK and American ratings. So did that up through about 1999, and then went back to grad school, became a historian, and then started working at the museum.
That's fantastic. It's almost a kind of a dream job, I think.
It is. There's not a day that goes by that I'm not in awe of what's around me. It really is amazing, and I wouldn't do anything else. I mean, this is, I can't imagine moving on to a different job. I wouldn't enjoy it as much.
Sure, I can understand that completely. Can you tell us a little about terminology? You know, everybody seems to get tripped up with, is it a drone? Is it a UAS? Is it a UAV? I mean, I think we know what all those things mean,
mm-hmm.
And our listeners do as well. But in terms of, you know, looking at it from a historical standpoint and going forward, what kind of problems does that cause? Everybody using different words for the same thing.
It does. And obviously industry and DOD, at times they're very anti-drone in terms of the terminology, yet frankly, there's some hypocrisy there. I can't tell you the number of times that I've heard both industry and DOD use drones as terminology. RPA was a popular phrasing for a while. You know, it got real popular during the 80s and then died off in favor of UAV. And now we see DOD's pushing RPA again, remotely piloted aircraft, as a popular thing. The big one early on wasn't drone so much, but really from the 40s and 50s, it was pilotless was always the terminology that was used, and that ultimately died out. So these things come and go, and there's not a lot of consistency with it, and you have to wonder. Certainly I've got my own opinions on this, but it seems like the Air Force got itself in a little bit of a bind when it picked terms like Predator and Reaper. for these systems. When you talk about having a Reaper with Gorgon stare on it, you know, and
it forms a mental image.
It has a certain connotation to it. And then when we talk about, you know, Customs and Border Protection flying these same platforms and people get worked up about it, you know, sometimes the rhetoric does matter, right? So, you know, there does need to be some consistency. I don't think drone's going away as the term du jour anytime soon. I mean, it's embedded in the culture, and we can talk UAVs, but, you know, the public just doesn't adopt that. And, you know, obviously those of us that are associated with these things can see the nuance and why you don't want to call certain categories of aircraft a certain thing. But the public just doesn't see that. And it's going to be a long road, I think, to really change behavior if that's the goal.
If it's even possible, I know. I think when David and I started, we tried to not use the term drone unless that was really applicable to the aircraft we were talking about. But I kind of came around to the position that, well, you know, because the public uses that term and because it has a negative connotation generally because of the military military applications, that maybe if you just kept using that word drone, but in life-saving contexts and in a different context, that it would just expand people's definition.
Absolutely. I'm with you 100% on that. And I think we are, just in the past couple of years, I think we are starting to see a shift. Even while there are these emerging concerns over privacy and so forth, I think the public is seeing a lot of positive press now about,
yes,
about the capabilities that are able to be demonstrated, life-saving capacity, all the positives for heavy industry in particular. You know, the things that you can do. You know, it's great not to have those poor helicopter pilots out there that are on power line patrol. You know, I mean, unfortunately, there's a bad record there. And if you can do that with an unmanned system, you know, let's do it.
Absolutely.
I guess we'll throw it to Robert. Anything else you want to talk about? Since you got a whole UAV geek audience, what else would you like to talk about?
Well, I think we're going to have a lot of interesting aircraft, you know, coming down the pike here pretty soon in terms of things that we're bringing into the museum. So here at Udvar-Hazy, we're looking at having a little display of some of the newer, smaller designs, so including the Dragonflyer. I don't know if you've met Evan Ulrich that's here with the RoboSeed. You should talk to Evan. I'll go get Evan for you. But he's a real character. He's got probably the most brilliant guy I've met recently. But you know, he's got a monocopter UAV, and essentially what it is it's your maple seed. It's a powered maple seed.
Yes, we know of this.
Right. So, you know, really amazingly simple, clever design. You know, I mean, he can have that thing GPS controlled, and you know, I keep waiting for him to have that thing hit the stores and, you know, have it under the Christmas tree. But I think it won't be too much longer.
There is a big, I don't want to say a big UAV display downtown, but you have Dark Star,
right?
Predator. What else am I missing?
So we have the Army Shadow. We've got a Marine Corps Dragon Eye down there as well. We've got the Navy Pioneer. The example that we display there is the one that the Iraqis surrendered to in Desert Storm. So kind of the first time that humans ever surrendered to a robot. You know, that's kind of a neat one. We've got the Boeing UCAV, the X-45. And, of course, that's the big question mark where this technology goes. I mean, you know, you look at what the Navy is doing with X-47. You know, there's a lot of concerns. And
has the museum put in the bid for that yet?
No, we've been offered X-47, and to be honest, I turned it down. And I'll tell you why. With that type of operational oriented aircraft, we like to get one that's been in service. So the same reason you don't see a V-22 Osprey in here. I want to get an Osprey that's done that historic mission. You know, El Primo mission. That's the one that we want for the museum. So same thing with U-Class and the X-47. Let's wait till the U-Class enters service, and we'll get the first one to fly a combat mission. That's what we'll go for.
Oh, I love that, because that's the thinking behind it. We've talked about, you know, every aircraft in here has some story to tell, and it's a little peek behind the curtains on how you would choose something like that.
Yeah,
thank you.
Fascinating. All right, Roger Connor, we want to thank you so much for spending a few minutes with us and our audience. It's been fascinating. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
Well, Max, you got to admit that I didn't know where the word drone came from, did you?
I had no idea. In fact, I probably really didn't think about it too much, but I'm glad Roger gave us that story and all the other information as well. The Air and Space Museum, the National Air and Space Museum, I think is a must-visit destination for anyone involved in aviation, and it was great to learn more about the UAV content that they have at the museum. So we want to thank Roger Connor for spending a few minutes with us during the event. I know he's a very busy guy, but David, I get the sense that he's having a lot of fun doing what he's doing.
We joke every year about me going there and it being a little slice of heaven for me, but it really is. And now that we have such great relationship with the museum and we get to meet all these people, hopefully Roger, when he hears this, when they do decide to get a UCAS, he'll invite us there for the debut of the museum. So, and we'll have some links in the show notes to some of the things that they talked about as far as museum exhibits.
All right. Well, I think that's going to do it just for this episode, a little shorter than usual, but we wanted to get this great content out to you. This has been episode 46. You can find us at theuavdigest.com. And if you'd like to get straight to the show notes, look for theuavdigest.com/46.
And if you want to leave us some feedback, remember the address is feedback@theuavdigest.com. And see our Twitter feed at @UAVDigest or facebook.com/UAVDigest. If you listen to us on iTunes, definitely, and love us, definitely leave us some feedback. And don't forget, you can always stream us to your phone on Stitcher.com.
All right. Well, with that, this has been Max in Hartford.
And David in Philly.
Thanks for listening.